Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. Jobs. That's the whole economic story right now. I mean, it really, honestly is. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the third day of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The economic through line, the second half of this week, is the labor market. Jobs, how many of them there are or maybe aren't. In reverse chronological order, the February monthly jobs report, that's the big one, comes out Friday morning. The weekly unemployment claims figure comes out tomorrow. And today we got private payroll numbers from the processing firm ADP. Not so bad, but not so good either. 117,000 new jobs in this economy, well below all the educated guesses out there. And another in a series of indicators that maybe this recovery is running out of gas, which is, of course, why Congress is working on that relief bill at this very moment. So Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us going on our rest of the week labor market update.
The jobs recovery in this pandemic is what Holly Wade calls disconnected. She runs the National Federation of Independent Business Research Center. On the one hand,
industries that are still struggling to keep their doors open in areas such as leisure and hospitality, the restaurant industries, those businesses that are more public facing.
Those businesses are going to be cautious about hiring, even as things start to reopen. At the same time, other industries can't find enough workers. Marla Balanik runs the Latino Economic Development Center.
Contractors have had, you know, an amazing last 12 months, maybe better than an average year, because people have more interest in improving their homes or their surroundings in general.
The relief bill does have targeted aid for some of the hardest hit industries, airlines, for example, and entertainment venues. But as Sarah Crozier at small business group Main Street Alliance points out,
the American Rescue Plan is at its core a rescue plan, right? We're still talking about triage. We're still talking about, you know, real COVID immediate needs.
Cash payments to families, help for the unemployed, money to reopen schools. Allison Schrager is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute.
I mean, it will definitely help. It will get more money in pockets, and that might help consumption some. But the only thing we can really do to restore the economy is end the disease.
Schrager says while the vaccines are cause for optimism, it will probably still take a while for the labor market to catch up. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The virus is still basically in charge of this economy, but that does not mean people and politicians are going to listen to it. A number of states and cities are starting to back off their restrictions and their limitations. San Francisco reopens indoor dining today. Massachusetts lifted capacity limits in restaurants this week. And in Texas, as I'm sure you've heard, they are doing away with all restrictions next week. No more masks or social distancing or capacity limits required. So as a purely business and economic point of order, what does full-on reopening look like at this point in this pandemic? Marketplace's Kristen Schwab talked to some Texans to get a sense.
Now that they can reopen, are businesses ready, willing, and able?
Yesterday was Texas Independence Day. They basically gave us our freedoms back.
I mean, it's not feasible for us.
This really feels like somebody came through and broke our kneecaps near the end of a marathon.
That was Trey Strange, Alba Huerta, and Jimmy Sweeney. Let's start with Strange. He owns the Silver Bullet, a bar and grill in Lubbock. And come next Wednesday,
there's no mask mandate. I'm not socially distancing my seats or tables anymore. We're a bar. We're going to go back to having fun.
Although fun may look different now. He's not going to pack the place, not for safety reasons, but because he thinks people just aren't used to crowded spaces or standing at the bar anymore. Then there's Alba Huerta, who owns Julep Bar in Houston, which has teetered between opening and closing. She says even if she wanted to get back to normal, it's just not possible, especially after Texas's recent winter storm and electricity blackouts.
The property is a 100-year-old building. We lost, you know, thousands of dollars in food. There's a lot of things that we need to do before we can prepare to be open to the public.
Some businesses plan to keep restrictions in place. For Jimmy Sweeney at the Grand Barry, a small independent movie theater in Fort Worth, that means mask mandates and social distancing. But he's worried that enforcing these rules will become more difficult and that COVID infections will rise and scare customers away.
We had started to see things really turn around over the last few weeks. This feels like it adds some sort of limbo, even if we try to enforce our restrictions ourselves.
Business owners in Texas are facing a bit of a Wild West, and now it's up to them and their customers to decide how they're going to live in it. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, well, you know, stocks do go down too. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The big bugaboo right now in tech, well, one of the bugaboos anyway, but definitely one of the biggest, privacy. Who's got your data and what are they doing with it? So an announcement from Google today caught our eye. The company said it's going to stop tracking what people do on the internet as they browse across different websites and apply that to their advertising rules. It is responding, Google says, to the aforementioned concerns about user privacy. So we did what we do when we've got a tech question. We got Molly Wood on the phone. She's the host of Marketplace Tech to explain exactly what Google is doing and whether it's actually going to lead to more digital privacy. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So, first of all, what are they doing, like, mechanically or technologically here?
Right. Mechanically and technologically, in January, actually, Google announced that it would limit what are called third-party cookies in its Chrome browser, which you may know in the United States has about 80% market share. Wow. So those are cookies from companies other than the website that you actually went to on purpose, right? Mm-hmm. So not Twitter.com. All these other cookies that are following you around the web, tracking everything you do and then collecting this database that they can, that advertisers can buy against. Other browsers have already done this. Google said we're not doing it. The big announcement this week too was Google saying we are also not going to build some other magic technology to individually track people to sell ads. They said we're just not going to sell ads based on your web browsing history anymore. We're going to instead group people into what they're calling cohorts of people like them and advertise that way.
So, yeah, so a little fuzziness in the data. So does this mean if I go on Zappos and search for, like, I don't know, trail running shoes, that the next time I go to the New York Times, I'm not going to see trail running shoe ads? Because that's what happens now, right?
Yeah, it's always Zappos. It's always the shoes. Yes, that is essentially what it should mean. It more means, though, that if you went to Zappos.com and then you went to 10 other websites after that, that cookies from a company, even Google, couldn't follow you to the 10 other websites. So they'd still know that you were into those shoes because that's the site you were on. But Zappos wouldn't follow you to the New York Times and be like, hey, what are you doing over here?
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay. As it happens, I am in the market for new running shoes on trails. But anyway, so what's the verdict here? Is this a privacy win?
It might. So experts I talked to said it could be. That part is unclear. We don't know, you know, how Google is going to group these cohorts. We don't know how specific they're going to be. It also doesn't necessarily address the fact that Google itself still has 1,000,001 ways to get information about you directly. Google doesn't even need to follow you across the web. It already knows from, you know, six other doorways, including your Fitbit. So it doesn't completely solve the privacy issue. It also, you know, Google is the owner of this space, and now they're saying everybody has to play by our rules, even though we kind of created the original rules. So companies that are in the ad tech business could be in trouble if they're doing things the old way. And it's unclear how it's all going to shake out. However, what everybody agrees on is it is a big deal because this is the set of rules that Google created. We've all played by this way. Everyone agrees that these third-party cookies are a huge privacy invasion. So it's not nothing.
Right, right. Okay. Change of gears here real quick. Facebook is going to start allowing political ads again starting tomorrow, I think. Discuss.
Yeah. I mean, you know, this is one of those situations where the horse is already so far from the barn that it's hard to imagine that the ban even made that much difference. And I have to say, just to be a little contrarian, in the long run, it's better for non-incumbents, independent candidates, people without as much money behind them to have a platform like Facebook to advertise on, especially since their rules banning political advertising were messy to start with.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. On this whole, you know, political ads thing, online thing is going to play out over years and months. Anyway, Molly Wood, she is mostly the host of Marketplace Tech, also with me every day, a podcast we do called Make Me Smart. Check it out, would you? We like it. We have fun doing it. Thanks, Molly.
No problem. I'll have some shoe recommendations for you later.
Good. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
A year ago this week, a tornado cut through Cookeville, Tennessee. It's a couple hours east of Nashville, city of about 34,000 people, most of whom were asleep when the tornado hit. 19 people were killed in Putnam County. Hundreds of homes and buildings were damaged or destroyed. People did decide to rebuild, yes, most of them. But putting everything back together again after a natural disaster can be a whole lot more emotional than a typical construction project. From WPLN, Blake Farmer has that one.
Like dozens in the area called Double Springs, the Williams family lost basically everything. There were literally two walls left, the walls of the bathroom they were huddled in when the tornado struck. The family decided to stay here and rebuild, though, their dream home, a fortress, really.
These are rated at 245-mile-an-hour wind loads. I don't think it's going to go anywhere.
Charles Williams slaps their new concrete walls 12 inches thick. A local building supply company gave him a survivor's discount. He doesn't want to say how much, but it made the upgrade affordable. And in their master bedroom closet, a concrete safe room, big enough for Charles, wife Tamara, and their three kids. They hope never to need it.
Or at least if we ever do, then hopefully there's more standing than what was standing that night.
There was nothing left last time. Something's better than anything. I know for a fact that closet's going to still be here. And we're going to be here.
They all have post-traumatic stress from the ordeal, Tamara says. It's been a trying year all around. Tamara, who's a nurse at the VA, got COVID and had to be hospitalized for 2 weeks. Charles had a heart attack along the way, and he was the one rebuilding their house since he couldn't find an affordable general contractor. He's taking it easier now.
Slowing down a little bit, but still plugging away at it.
The combination of COVID restrictions and the related building boom that's driven up the price of lumber and appliances has made recovering from the storm slower than many families would have liked. But half a mile away, Terry McWilliams says she's been okay with that.
Everybody's like, you'll be in your house for the 1 year anniversary. And I'm like, I'm kind of glad we're not.
McWilliams, who's an accountant and mother of three, wasn't so sure she wanted to rebuild. Her teenage son was very nearly sucked away as they dove into the basement. Her husband, Ted, was traveling for work that night and returned ready to clean up and start over.
He was just like, hey, we're going to build. I mean, what's the problem? And I'm like, because I might not want to live there anymore.
And I had a good come to Jesus for me. You know, I didn't realize they went through this. I didn't.
The first tornado warning after the storm, Terry nearly had a panic attack at the office and worried about protecting her kids. Ultimately, the McWilliams decided to rebuild, though they say their homeowner's insurance hasn't covered the cost of a few improvements, like slightly sturdier walls. And while the construction sites tell one story, the empty lots tell another more painful tale. Brian Selby draws the blinds to look out the back window on his family's property.
Now, this house to the left is my aunt's. And then right here past the boat was Mom and Dad's.
He's in the house where he watched his parents' mobile home get ripped from its foundation. His parents didn't survive the storm. Selby says the tragedy from a year ago has transformed the community. Instead of just waving, neighbors have conversations and share meals.
Several times I thought about leaving, but after this, I wouldn't go nowhere.
Where his parents lived is now a flat patch of grass, but a few empty lots nearby have been purchased by the local government to build a park and playground as a memorial to those who died. In Putnam County, Tennessee, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Fungible, just kind of a funny sounding word.
I mean, it kind of is, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials down 119 points today, just shy of 0.4%, 31,270. The NASDAQ dropped 361 points, 2.7%, 12,997. The S&P 500 down 50, 1.3%, 3819. As we heard from Ms. Molly Wood, Google says it's going to phase out some kind of ad tracking technology from its Chrome browser. Google parent company Alphabet down 2.5% today. Facebook down 1.3%. Zoom video communications crashed. Get it? Crashed. Down 8.3%. Maybe it thinks the virus is over. I don't know. If you've ordered anything online lately, you will have noticed those top-of-the-screen delivery advisories, the storms and extreme cold in many parts of this country still causing bottlenecks for carriers. FedEx down 0.3% today. UPS lost just over 0.5%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury, 1.48%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas. Loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You want your stuff, your products, your manufactured goods, your raw materials to get someplace in this global economy, you are going to need some cargo space. Something like 80% of international trade goes by sea, and as the global economy rebounds, there are huge backlogs in containerized cargo. Shipping rates are going up as well. And interestingly enough, demand for air cargo space is back to where it was in the before times. Good news for airlines, yes. But as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports, not quite good enough.
You ever look out the window of an airplane on the tarmac and seen like all those weird Star Wars looking vehicles moving boxes or suitcases or fuel? Well, Mark Pollock's company supplies the parts for all of that stuff.
Transmissions, the hydraulic systems, all of those replacement parts.
His company is called Sage Parts, and he can basically take the temperature of the airline industry by looking at the orders he gets. Business is way down, for the most part, but there's one group that is still coming to him clamoring for parts.
Our cargo customers, our package carriers, people like FedEx, UPS, Amazon, you know, doing very well.
Basically, we are buying a lot of stuff these days, so demand for air cargo is back to pre-pandemic levels. Overall, cargo revenue up 75% year over year in December. Passenger airlines benefit from this. They do actually carry goods. You might have a row to yourself in the cabin, but you can bet the cargo hold below you is crammed full of freight. Burke Huey is an equity analyst at Morningstar.
United, for example, generally has 2 to 3% of its revenue be cargo revenue. In 2020, that figure jumped to about 10% of revenue.
Huey says United generated about $1.6 billion just in cargo revenue last year. But it had an operating loss of about $6.3 billion, which gets us to the bottom line. Samuel Engel is with consulting firm ICF.
A few more packages doesn't make up for a missing half a billion passengers.
Even if all the airlines took the expensive step of converting some of their passenger planes into full-on freight carriers, and some have, the increased capacity would probably lower the price of freight to the point where airlines were still massively in the hole. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Sometimes Sabri hosts the Marketplace Morning Report as well. Not tomorrow, though. It's going to be David Brancaccio and the gang that get out of bed way too early, telling you everything you need to know to start your economic day. Check it out. There's a thing happening in the digital world that's not really new. They've been around for 4 or 5 years, but the buzz is building, as they say, around these things called non-fungible tokens. Sounds techie, sounds vaguely crypto-y, and it is basically digital rights to a digital thing. And they're getting expensive, too, like 6 or 7 figures expensive. So we got Jamie Wild on the phone to explain. She's a writer for Morning Brew. Jamie, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
For somebody who has never heard of non-fungible tokens, what are these things?
Great. So you already broke down the acronym for me, which is great. And the main aspect of it really is that word fungible, just kind of a funny sounding word, but what it means is that something can be exchanged and that it's not unique. So when it's non-fungible, two different NFTs are unique from each other. So I like to compare it to Pokemon cards. So you don't you're not going to trade a Ghastly for a holographic Charizard, but they are just pieces of paper. You know, they're tokens that represent the actual things, just like an NFT. An NFT represents a digital asset, and that digital asset can be anything, and that value can vary.
Okay, so as a real life example, I'm just going to pick the whole NBA Top Shots thing. The NBA is making money selling, as I understand it, video copies of various game moments, except they're encrypted on the blockchain somehow. Does that make sense?
It does make sense to me. I can understand how it can sound a little confusing.
Yeah, but so here's my question, though, right? I can go online and watch LeBron James dunk until the cows come home. But somehow the NBA has found a way to put these things on the blockchain, turn them into NFTs, and is now selling them for like 6 figures plus.
Yep. I mean, it just depends on how you really think of value, right? For me, it kind of makes sense that these just digital assets, even if you can see them elsewhere, are valuable just because you own them. Yeah. And for things like digital art, that becomes really important because maybe they don't have a physical component at all. And I think if you know, when you grow up living and breathing the internet, the importance of having your name owning a meme that had such cultural ramifications, for instance, I don't know, makes more sense.
Yeah, and look, this all makes sense as we become more of an internet-based society and go eventually completely digital as we will. We're clearly on the leading edge of this thing. But let me back you up for a minute. So forget the NBA and forget, making more money off LeBron. If I'm a photographer or an artist, this is an opportunity for me.
Absolutely. And we're seeing more and more artists make it an opportunity, and we're seeing them break each other's records all the time. Grimes just sold some pieces for hundreds of thousands of dollars, and that was really fascinating to see. And for creators, especially ones that are completely digital, this is really just finally saying that their work is valuable in a way that they can make money off of beyond ads. Or even for music artists, you know, beyond streaming, which they've, you know, always had issues with. So,
Right. So back to this Grimes example, right? Who is, I think, as of the latest reading, Elon Musk's significant other. So just
to frame it in terms of pop culture references. Mm-hmm. So I buy this NFT from Grimes and I pay $100,000. There's nothing that says I can't resell it for $150, right?
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah. So secondary market exists.
There is a secondary market, and I know in particular, like for NBA Top Shot, there is, and I believe for this art, there definitely will be. So yeah, you either buy NFTs because you have some intrinsic emotional attachment to them, or you buy it because you think someone else will have that mm-hmm. value attached to it and want to buy it from you and that you can make money off of it.
Yep. Makes sense. Jamie Wild, she's a writer at Morning Brew, writing on NFTs most recently. Jamie, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, I appreciate talking to you. It's really fun for me to talk about this.
This final note on the way out today. Saw this on Bloomberg this morning using some Google mobility data. And remember what Molly was saying about Google having a million and one ways to make money off data. Commuting in this economy, apparently, in the last week of February is back up to where it was last March. Specifically, the average number of visits to places of work, that is the nomenclature, are the highest they have been since March the 20th of last year. Related, perhaps, and of interest definitely to all those people doing all that commuting, crude oil up 2.6% today. The U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate now at $61.28 a barrel. Gas prices, I hear you asking? $2.73 a gallon, says AAA as a national average. 1 year ago, what do you think? $2.42. All right, we got to go. Not, though, without your midweek moment of economic context, doing business in Texas edition. Kristen Schwab is telling us about what local businesses down there are doing about the virus situation and Governor Abbott's opening up order. Bigger companies are doing their own thing. Thank you very much. Hyatt Hotels, Target, Starbucks, also CVS, to name a couple, say they are going to keep their mask requirements in place. Why? Because the virus is still actually in charge of this economy. That's why. Our media production team is Brian Allison, Robin Edgar, Drew Jostet, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Jay Siebold, Liana Squilacci, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Talladay, and Becca Weinman. The ones coming in, so the rest of us don't have to remember that. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.